and welcome to Worlds Apart. The American political and economic debate may have been reduced to slogans on bumper stickers, but the state and the course of the U.S. economy still remain a crucial factor for other nations to consider as they chart their own development. What's the outlook, and are there any practical safeguards against the unruly trendsetter? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Igor Makarov, head of the School of World Economy at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Igor, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for this time.
Hello, glad to be here.
Now, by the very nature of his character, Donald Trump is prone to stirring emotions and attract a lot of negative and positive attention. But to be fair, the American economy had been saddled with multiple crises long before he came to power. Do you think Donald Trump is likely to alleviate or exacerbate them?
Yeah, I think that Trump is not it triggers the problem. It is rather a symptom of the problem. Because as you really said, so the fundamental problems within the American economy, they have been developed for the last decades, and especially after the financial crisis of 2008-2009. And actually the shift towards this concentration on itself, towards like slogans like Make America Great Again, they started actually since Barack Obama, and so of course.
Well, to some extent, they're also a nature. They reflect the nature of the American culture in the debate.
To some extent, yes, but this shift from hyper-globalization of the 1990s, 2000s, by the example of a particular country, it really started in 2010s. And even Obama tried to implement some measures to take American production back to the U.S. and so on. But of course, Trump strengthened all that.
Can I ask you, you said that Trump is more of a symptom, but when it comes to the policies or solutions that he proposes, do you see any sort of intuition or any wisdom in them? Because it's very easy to ridicule them, and a lot of American media are doing that, but is he right at least on some points?
Yeah, of course. And actually, I think that he has at least three major motivations. First, of course, he appeals to the majority of the American population, to the silent majority, like blue collars and all the people, the communities around them, who actually lose from globalization. Actually, globalization was not the only problem they faced, but it is the easiest to accuse and the easiest to address them. You can't address like technical change, for example, which makes like coal industry really want. So it is the first motivation. The second motivation is the attempt to do something with fundamental imbalances within the U.S. economy. So first of all, trade imbalance, but also a budget deficit and national debt as well. It is highly debated whether it is possible to address these issues with
such. Well, can I ask you on that point, because I heard you say in another interview that as bad as the American debt and trade deficit problems are, you think they are manageable as opposed to Trump's propensity to just cause shock among the markets and among the partners. Economically speaking, why is that a problem, the sort of shock factor of Trump?
Well, in principle, it is not normal when one country has a negative trade balance for such a long period of time, for more than.
But America is not just one country; it's a very special country.
That's true, but these imbalances they accumulate, and they are converted to the rise of foreign debt. And given the rise of interest rates in the United States, it becomes more and more painful to pay for this foreign debt, and so the share of debt payments in budget expenses, it increases dramatically, and it is really necessary to do something with that. Probably not in the very, very short term, and it is the American economy could live with that for some years, but nobody knows how long. But in principle, this is a problem, of course, and it should be addressed.
But you said it's manageable, unlike the way Trump tries to deal with that by causing a lot of shock. Why shock is an issue here?
Again, because there are also other motivations within this. So there are political motivations or the appeal to the silent majority of people. And of course, this is very well combined with the objective to fix these imbalances. And the third motivation, which is very trivial, actually, it is simple beggars and neighbor policy. So, and the major vulnerable neighbor is the European Union. So what the United States does now with all these tariffs and with trade negotiations, it just beggars the European Union, which is in position of a country which is very vulnerable of all this and is not able to do anything with that. I think that given that the general pie of the American economy is not growing as fast as previously, so beggars and neighbor is a good policy in the short term.
Now, if we look at these double-digit tariffs that you mentioned, that the Trump administration introduced against both friends and foes, do you see them primarily as a political measure to sort of force trading partners into submission, or do you think they may indeed reshape the way the American and global economy are structured, you know, the fundamentals or the logic of the economic processes?
Yeah, I think that there is understanding among American political elites, at least Republican elites that are now on power, that the structure of globalization and the structure of the global capitalism, it's stopped working for America. And that on this field, China is starting to win already. And so the natural solution is to try to change the field, try to change the whole rules, how the system is working. But at the same time, political issues also matter because, yeah, Trump anyway should win elections, and he appeals to these blue collars who are their voters, actually. And so it is always a combination.
Now, we have already seen that Trump's tariffs policies have inspired some rekindling in the China-India relations, and from the statements of their leaders, it's pretty obvious that it's not only a matter of trade, though that is very important, but it's also a question of national pride. How far do you think the United States under Trump is willing to go in this tariff antagonism towards Beijing and New Delhi in particular? Because sure, all countries are equal, but some are bigger than others and have more impact just by the virtue of their size.
Yeah, actually, there was a paper a couple of weeks ago by Jim O'Neill, who actually invented the acronym BRICS, which had as a headline, Trump is a secret agent of BRICS, which is, of course, not true. Actually, of course, he strengthened BRICS dramatically. And what he did with India, and actually with Brazil as well, so he just pushed it towards other.
Well, Igor, it's a very popular and to some extent very pleasing argument for the Russians and for many other BRICS countries. But we know that BRICS as an institution has been rather slow in coming together and implementing sort of practical policy and practical cooperation. And in part, that's because many BRICS members wanted to hedge their bets between the East, the West, the South, etc.
Yeah, India, for example.
Absolutely, because India used to be a darling of the United States, getting all the exemptions. Now, do you think the recent developments around Trump, associated with Trump, are likely to make BRICS a little bit more agile and a little bit more practical in sort of not only paying lip service to the BRICS idea, but actually, you know, working it in reality?
I think that some countries are really willing to move to this direction. And for example, Lula da Silva already declared the new BRICS summit, which would be devoted directly to the joint response to Trump measures. And actually, this is what BRICS countries should do. So to collectively respond, to start some collective resistance to these changes in world economic order. And for BRICS, it is like a chance to redefine itself. And India here is absolutely crucial because the major role of India in BRICS for previous years was just not to make BRICS anti-Western, actually, to balance between these two poles. Mm. But now India had nothing.
They called it a non-alignment. Yeah, I mean, in their terms.
Non-alignment. And you are absolutely right about this issue of national pride, because the manner how it was done with India, it's left absolutely no room to Modi. And so probably many representatives of Indian elites, they were ready to negotiate with US.
I do want to come back to BRICS a little bit later, but before we do that, let me ask you a couple of questions on the America specifically, because you studied there, you're a specialist in the American economy, and the US officials to this point seem to be pretty confident that the partners may strike a pose, may be offended for a while, but sooner or later they will come around, simply because the American value, the American market rather, in their view, still remains the most coveted market in the world. Do you think it's accurate? Does it correspond with the realities of the time?
Well, US is about 15% of the global economy in terms of PPP. So it's not too much, actually. It's not too little, of course, and US is still the largest economy in the world in terms of GDP, nominal GDP. But still, it is not a economic hegemon anymore, at least in such a manner as it was 20 or 30 years ago. So I'm not sure that there would be any resistance to these measures and formulation of new proposals to how the world economy may work, probably from BRICS, probably from China itself, and within there some bilateral agreements between China and other major emerging economies. So I think that this confidence that US economy is unique and you may weaponize American markets without any consequences, it is... It may have consequences, actually.
Okay.
The measures of Trump, they really push the other major actors.
Well, and that may be a silver lining in all this unpredictability. But before we move any further, let's take a short break. Mm-hmm. We will be back in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
Catch yourself questioning more.
Like, why do I always parrot everything the US State Department says?
Or why I always ask, do you condemn Hamas, but never Israel?
Why I never said sorry for spreading the debunked Trump Russiagate hoax?
Why I support every illegal war the US has launched this century?
Why I can't stop lying that Joe Biden was young and healthy enough for the presidency?
Why we ignore our rock bottom ratings and pretend people still want to watch the same old bullshit?
The only reason we're asking
is because RT generated this video
and made us do it.
So you'll never get answers, at least not from us.
Happy anniversary to RT. I may be an AI, but there's no way I'm saying that.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Igor Makarov, head of the School of World Economy at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Igor, for a long time, it was a sort of truism in economic circles that the more value-added your exports are, the more advanced, the more secure you are as a nation. But I think the recent developments, as well as the earlier case with Russia's exports, show that sometimes, or at least in these times, it's far easier to reorient your export of raw materials onto other markets than the trade of more processed goods. Is that the case, and how do you think it's likely to influence the developmental logic of export-oriented nations?
I think it really has very important implications. And before 2022, everybody looked at the Russian GDP and said that it is so small, like 2% of the global GDP. So what Russia can do against the Western countries? And even now, the Europeans say like that, actually. Look at the Russian economy, it is so small compared to ours. Look at the capitalization of the Russian companies. Coca-Cola has larger capitalizations than Gazprom. Labubu has larger capitalizations than the largest Russian companies.
Well, it's a very simplified American bumper sticker.
Absolutely. But it is. It really matters in the times of peace. Now we have a time of economic war. And in time of economic war, absolutely different indicators matter and absolutely different metrics matter. And self-reliance on natural resources, which was to some extent the weakness of the Russian economy, it becomes to some extent the strength of the Russian economy. That's true. Moreover, as you said, it matters whether you may substitute or whether your expert specialization, your categories you specialized on, may be substituted by other suppliers or by some alternative raw materials or something like that. This matters in a time of economic war. And it's also a good news for countries like Brazil, for example, which is very afraid right now about these 50% tariffs. Many of them really believe that the Brazilian economy may be severely hit by it, by this, as many in Russia believe that the Russian economy.
And it's also an additional incentive for President Lula to put more attention into BRICS and perhaps more.
Yeah, for sure. But actually, the good news is that the Russian economy survived because it was specialized in raw materials which have demands everywhere and which can't be substituted easily. The same is with Brazilian exports, the same is with Chinese exports, even to more extent, and so on and so forth. So the global trade will adjust to that, and the trade of the largest economies, at least, like BRICS economies, it would also adjust to the strong measures.
What does it mean for the sort of the outline of the global economy as a whole, that there would be more more demand or more orientation towards a raw material, and then the countries would have to do the rest of it within themselves? Is it a trend towards more self-sufficiency, at least in terms of processed goods?
For sure. International trade is good because it is efficient, right? And it increases the efficiency of the economy and it promotes economic growth. Of course, it still matters and it is still important. But at the same time, there are issues of security, there are issues of independence, there are issues of more self-reliance. And the countries are already starting to balance these issues. Not only the BRICS countries and the West themselves as well. So they try to decrease reliance on China, which is...
Reliance on raw materials as well. I mean,
for sure.
An interesting trend.
From Russian raw materials as well.
Now, I heard one prominent Chinese expert say that in Mandarin, the word currency stands for both money and goods. And in his view, Russia has succeeded in making its trade more about goods than money ahead of the current time. So essentially, we have like a three and a half year warning than the rest of the global economy. Could that be a recipe for surviving turbulent times? I think you partially addressed that already, but I mean, in terms of making that a sort of the more resilient paradigm, do you think it's likely to work?
Yeah, we call Russian story vis-a-vis sanctions a large economy trap. Russia is a large economy in economic sense for most of its major export categories, like natural gas, like oil, of course, fertilizers, some metals, like non-ferrous metals, for example, uranium, and so on. It is a large economy. What does it mean? It means that if you even limit the exports of these categories to the global market, it would convert into the rising prices. And so if you even limit Russian exports in natural terms, in absolute terms, then the rise of price, because of that, it would compensate the losses of Russia, of Russian budget, of Russian exports, and so on. It works when you are the large economy in markets. Russia has some problems with coal, for example. Russia has some problems with iron and steel. Why? Because Russia is not a large economy in these markets. And if Russian goods are isolated, it doesn't convert to the rising prices, and these industries have problems. Mm-hmm. The same story would work for Brazil, the same story would work for India in markets where they are large. So they may capitalize it, and they will be resilient, very resilient on this market. Russia is happy that it is really a large economy for most of its exports, which was, again, a weakness of the Russian economy in times of peace, but it is a strength.
But it's also a very interesting, I guess, lesson for many professionals and non-professionals, that sometimes your weaknesses can be turned into your major strengths, and your major strengths could be turned into your major weaknesses, as the case with the United States. Now, can I ask you a larger, I guess, philosophical question, or perhaps a scientific one? Do you think the Bretton Woods system, the way it was designed with its sort of centering on the US dollar, do you think its crisis was inevitable, or its disintegration even was inevitable?
I think that when you create a system where the such strong dependencies are created around dollar in this case, then you should be ready. Then when a hegemon has problems, it starts to weaponize.
I think for that you need to, have a space for that thought that a hegemon may have problems in the first place, because I think hegemon until recently thought that the end of history would be
Some people in US still believe like that, but objectively speaking, US plays a smaller and smaller role in the global economy just because of objective demographic reasons, because of objective economic reasons. The major emerging economies, they grow much faster, and it is natural, it is okay, it is a course of history, so there is nothing very bad in that. But again, if you create so much dependencies, if you create like military dependence between, for example, Europe or Japan on the one hand and US on the other hand, to some extent, it may become a problem for these countries. When you create dependencies on dollar, it may become the problem to those who are too much dependent on dollar.
Or even for you.
Hegemon starts to weaponize it.
For yourself, because I heard you say that the prospect of replacing the US dollar as a global reserve currency is minimal, at least in the near term, not only because there are no viable alternatives, but because economically it's not an attractive proposition. Not many countries, even China, want to be in that position because it undermines the sort of the value of your own exports. Why is that?
When we think about dollar and speak about dollar, we should separate different dimensions. Reserve currency, that's true, and it is very difficult to substitute dollar with any other currency, especially given that the euro, which could be the alternative potentially, it has even larger problems. And actually right now, dollar substitutes euro in the structure of reserves of many countries, and its share is even increasing. It's maybe substituted by gold, which actually happens right now, and you may look at the dynamics of gold market. It is skyrocketing actually because everybody wants to substitute dollar with gold in reserves. But still in reserves, it is problematic. But in payments, it is easier, because what is the role of dollar in the global payments? It is like an intermediate between payments between different countries. Like right now, the technologies already developed so quickly that probably intermediate is not necessary as much as before. And the new digital technologies, digital currencies of central banks, the new technologies associated with digital banking in general, so they make dollar less necessary as an intermediate. It does not mean that dollar may be substituted by yuan or by anything else in this matter. It won't, because nobody wants to take this position, as you said. But probably this role would not be necessary at all. And so there would be more and more payments in national currencies. What we have now, probably there would be some new instruments, probably BRICS Pay or something like that. There are already many emerging alternatives, which may be really the problem for dollar, at least in this area. Mm-hmm. But the process of de-dollarization, it would last for a long time, of course, and we should not expect that dollar would be excluded from the international system like tomorrow.
Now, this issue is very popular within the BRICS circles, and you mentioned already President Lula's intention to convene an extraordinary BRICS summit to sort of coordinate policies against Trump. And I think a few years ago, Russia was eager for such an coordinated action against the West. But after Trump's and Putin's meeting in Alaska, what role do you think Russia is likely to play if BRICS or other Russian partners were to try to gang up against Washington?
Well, this is a common question of many experts and many media in non-Western countries. Probably Russia has turned back to the West.
Well, it doesn't have to turn back, because I think Russia does not operate on polarities, but I think its position has shifted, hasn't it?
It has shifted tactically, of course. In general, it is always better to have good relations at least some neutral relations and bad relations. And so it is better to have dialogue with the United States than not to have dialogue. But it does not mean that the fundamental objectives of the development of the Russian economy, they have changed. Anyway, Russian economy should be more oriented to the countries of the global south, to Asian countries, to African countries, just not because it is correct politically or it is a response to what we have with the Western countries right now, but because objectively these are the increasing markets. It is much more beneficial to be oriented at the increasing markets than to be oriented on the stagnating market of the European Union, or to start to develop some trade relations with the US, which are not very reliable on the one hand, and they are very small actually. This is nearly zero level of relations.
Well, at this point of time, I guess that leaves me a space for my last question. During their meeting in Alaska, President Putin hinted that there are potential areas of cooperation large-scale potential, like in the Arctic, in space, in technology, what have you. But as you pointed out, the current trade between Russia and the United States is very minimal. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why President Putin can talk very straightforwardly and without fawning to President Trump. Do you think it's worthwhile for Russia to, try to invest in developing its wider trade with the United States, even if there are openings, even if the American administration is eager for that?
Except for volumes of trade turnover or investments, issues of technology, they matter. And Russia has problems with access to technologies. And these joint projects with the US, if they happen actually, which is not very obvious for me, frankly speaking. But if they happen, so I think that they are considered as a way to get additional access to some new high-tech technologies. And I think that it is very positive by itself. But it should not be considered as a substitute of China or anything else. It is complementary. Russia, as many BRICS countries as well, they tried to be more balanced. And we were absolutely unbalanced in terms of international trades towards the West before recently. But right now, probably we are a little bit unbalanced towards the East. So movement towards balancing of different our trade partners and investment partners, it is a good strategy anyway. And I think that Russia should continue to move towards this direction.
Igor, it's been great talking to you. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.